The Data Practices Conference Committee on Senate File 863 will come to order. Today is May 6, 2010. I'm Senator Mary Olson. I'm the chair of the Data Practices Subcommittee on the Senate side. And perhaps Senator Limmer would like to introduce himself as well.
Yes, I'm Senator Warren Limmer. I'm from the northwest corner of Hennepin County, and approximately 140 homes that straddle into Wright County. And many people know both the chairwoman and myself have a keen interest in data privacy and the protection of our consumers in our state, and trying to find that delicate balance between state interest and private interest. So I'm glad to be here.
Thank you. And thank you all very much for your patience. The situation that has caused our delay, I think I already explained off the record for you while you were waiting. And I just want to tell you what we thought we would do. I talked to Senator Limmer, explained the situation as I explained it to you. And we really feel for the people who've taken their time to come here today, because certainly Ms. Beyer-Kopinski has had an issue that she's been patient about for a couple of years, worked hard on, and really would like to get resolved. And we know that there are other people here who have, you know, in the bigger scheme of things statewide, perhaps minor issues, but still they're very important issues for them. And we really thought that perhaps one way we could really bend over backward, even under the circumstances I described, to try to accommodate people who have concerns and don't want to be caught in the middle of whatever reason that we're having difficulty getting House members here, that we should hear your testimony, because really these are things that we have not heard in the Senate side. That's the reason for conference committees, when we have differences of opinion, or I shouldn't say differences of opinion necessarily, but differences in bills between the House and the Senate. And perhaps if we at least get your testimony, have heard the issue and gotten it on the record, that we're at least keeping something alive through the rest of the day and honoring the fact that you gave of your time to be here. And so once we've done that on these issues that are in the House bill and not in the Senate bill, then we will recess and continue to hope that the House decides to get together with us at some point. Senator Limmer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, and just for the record, representing the Republican caucus and you, of course, in the DFL caucus, I think we're both in agreement that the issue of data privacy is a critical issue, not only for how government works in relationship to the citizens, but wrestling with these issues with the advent of computers and technology, data privacy becomes an even heightened concern in light of some of the government expenses that sometimes our policies trigger. It, too, is an even more prominent in our discussions. But in light of an absent House membership on this conference committee, it is absolutely imperative for us to hear some of the issues that are represented on the House bill that are not included in the Senate bill. We want to become familiar with the concerns and the issues so that we're totally prepared to deal with writing good law. And I think it's our responsibility to investigate all of the issues that have been raised in the legislative process. And I agree that we should take time, listen to the concerns that are in the House bill that are not in the Senate, listen to the testimony that we have not been made formally aware of, and that way we will have it on record. Everyone will know, at least in the Senate, what's here. Whether there are people that are government employees in the room or whether you're legislators, the responsibility first goes to the citizen. We're all trying to work on behalf of the citizen to make government work as well and as efficiently as possible. And we in the Senate are not going to shirk our responsibility on these critical issues. So I welcome the testimony that we can hear.
Thank you, Senator Limmer. And in fairness to Representative Johnson, I should say that his L.A. told us this morning that he's out ill today, apparently. I guess as of yesterday, although that word wasn't conveyed to our office, but apparently he's not attending anything today because of an illness. So I just wanted to make sure that that was clear. So that being said, why don't we begin? I guess the first difference that is in our bill is in terms of a House provision we haven't heard has to do on the side-by-side in under R3, House Article 1, Section 5, having to do with appraisal data. Is there someone here who could testify with regard to that subject? Welcome to our conference committee, sir. Would you please state your name for the record?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Joe Harris. I'm a Dakota County Commissioner. And I'd like to address you today on this Data Privacy Act issue that has come up in Dakota County, and I would assume other governmental agencies across the state have also dealt with it in the past. The Dakota County Board of Commissioners supports amending the Minnesota Government Data Privacy Act to allow public agencies to voluntarily share real estate appraisals with landowners prior to executing a purchase agreement. Currently, the Minnesota Governmental Privacy Act, as it pertains to real estate appraisal produced by public agencies seeking to acquire property, are classified as confidential data. Thus, we cannot share that information with the general public until the acquisition has been done. The limitations of the current law negatively impact real estate negotiations with volunteer sellers, especially those landowners willing to donate a portion of their property for whatever cause that the local unit of government is working on. In Dakota County, we have the Farmland Natural Area Protection Program, where over the last 6 or 7 years, we've protected almost 10,000 acres of land, either on outright acquisition of natural areas or conservation easement or non-development land protection easements that we purchase from the farming community, ag producers, in order to protect a open space within Dakota County. Many of our sellers, all of our sellers that we negotiate come to us, make application. They're willing sellers that we're working with, and we'd like to be able to share our appraisal information with them because many of them are also donating a portion of the dollar amount towards us and minusing it off of the appraisal information that that we've paid for. So that's one of the reasons that it's, we're sitting at a kitchen table working with an individual saying, hey, trust us. This is what's in our appraisal. Let's sign the deal. And they're saying, well, can I see the appraisal? And by law, we can't show them the appraisal.
Sir, could you help me to understand why, what's the rationale for not sharing all appraisal data? I mean, why do we have a law to begin with that says you can't share that information? There may be a reason, I'm not sure that I know it because, there's probably a rationale I'm just not aware of, and since I don't work in this area, I don't know what it is. But I'm inclined to usually think whenever we're dealing with public information that it would be better to just have everything as open as it can possibly be unless there's a really good reason to keep something from being open. So when you raise this subject, it just makes me wonder why we don't just change the law to say that it would always be open data. But maybe there's a reason not to do that. So
well, we're asking that governmental agencies can, if they want to, voluntarily share that information. We're not saying that they have to share the information. I mean, there's many circumstances where in right-of-way acquisition and things of that nature, when we're not dealing with a willing seller through condemnation, we don't necessarily want to share our appraisal information. So this what we're asking for is to allow us to voluntarily share it in certain situations. And it's my understanding the current law doesn't allow us to share any confidential information at all.
Senator Limmer?
The way your request is written, does it mean, sir, that you could say no to a request for an appraisal?
Yes, is my understanding.
So Senator, you would be, you, the power of the county would be at your discretion to share data to any request.
That is correct. So,
and then if it goes beyond an individual that you're conducting a proposal for, can a neighbor request that information, or can anyone request it? Or do you wish to keep it limited to the party involved in the negotiations that you're dealing with?
Madam Chair, Senator, the program that I pointed out, our Farmland and Natural Area Program, individuals make application, and most of their information is already made public through the application process and through county board actions at public meetings and hearings. The actual appraisal on that particular property, once it would become public, if we're negotiating with a voluntarily seller again, that information could be made public to anybody that would request it. I would assume we would ask the individual that we're working with in, say, a conservation easement or a development easement type purchase, we would ask them if we would be allowed to make this public to, say, their neighbors or whatever.
Well,
Senator Limmer?
Madam Chair, usually the way data practice works is, especially with government information, usually if it's available to one, it's available to all. And I don't know of too many places where we allow government to have a discretion whether or not one party gets it and one party does not, or if they get it at all. So I think we, in trying to keep it in line with other data practice, governing practices, I don't know of too many places, if any, that we create a discretionary power for the individual, for the government entity that's holding information to say, yes, you can get it, or no, you can't. I can see if there's a dispute or whether there's a an unfriendly relationship between two parties. I don't know if giving one party the ability to withhold information is wise. Maybe I'm interpreting your answer wrong, but am I or am I not?
Madam Chair, Senator.
Sir. And I'm sorry, could you repeat your name? I should have written it down, but.
Commissioner Joe Harris from Dakota County.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator, it's my understanding how the law is written, that we're proposing, is that once it's made public to one individual, it's public to all. Okay, first, let me clarify that. And again, in our particular issue with Dakota County is we're dealing with willing sellers. We're dealing with willing people that are stepping forward, and it would be Dakota County's, under what we're asking for under the law changes as a governmental agency, if we would choose to share that appraisal with that particular individual, we will be able to. Under current law, we can't do that. And once we would determine to share that appraisal with that particular individual, that would then become a public document.
Commissioner Harris, just to follow up with something that on Senator Limmer's line of questioning, and again, I'm a lawyer, but this isn't my area of the law, so I apologize if I misstate how this works because I'm not that familiar with it. But based on the little bit that I know, it seems to me like what you're saying is that if you are going through some type of a condemnation type of proceeding with an involuntary seller, and you've had an appraisal done to determine how much you're going to offer that person for the property that you've decided you want to condemn, that you don't have to disclose that information under existing law, which frankly really surprises me that you wouldn't. And so apparently if they don't want your price and they think then they have to go get their own appraisal at their expense, I would assume, and then contest it through some type of legal proceeding. And so, again, my initial reaction to that is, why isn't that public information? Now, there's probably a reason, and I see Ms. Byer-Kopinski is going to fill us in on this, but I just would also like to say that this is exactly why we need to have some kind of open meeting on this so we can understand it. And frankly, if this had come through the normal process, we could have talked about this in judiciary and probably fleshed this out a little bit more so we understood it better. But it just seems to me like, especially in an involuntary proceeding, my initial reaction is all the more reason why I'd want to make sure that this was public information. And also, it seems like then what the county would be saying is, well, when it isn't in our interest to share it, we don't want to share it. But if we want someone to give us the information, we want to be able to share it so that they don't have to go to the expense of having their own appraisal or so that they trust us. And I can understand from the county's perspective why you would want to do that, and that's something for us to consider. But we have to also look more broadly at our constituents and try to decide if it's balanced and fair as far as what's in the law. So anyway, with that, Ms. Byer-Kopinski, could you shed some light on this issue?
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, what my recollection is of this, and coming from a real estate family, is the reason that this classification was put into place was to make sure that the government, when they were entering into these kinds of negotiations, wasn't put at a competitive disadvantage, that with their need to protect the taxpayers and how much they pay for property, that they would have the ability to shield these appraisals while they were in those negotiations until specific actions would have occurred. So I think it was really in the interest of making sure that the government could negotiate just like any other party would about what something is worth and make sure the taxpayers got the fair value for that property.
Well, Ms. Byer-Kopinski, I guess my reaction to that is, okay, that helps to clarify a little bit. I can understand that argument, but I can also, seems to me, that when someone is the subject of an involuntary condemnation procedure, to make sure that they're being treated fairly would make more sense for them to have access to that and not to be... And, you know, I've heard I can remember a little bit now, it's kind of coming back to me, hearing people who've been involved in these processes, and part of the distrust of the whole involuntary condemnation process has been around the idea that they can't even get access to an appraisal that was paid for with public dollars. And so then they have to go to the expense of having their own appraisal, which really doesn't seem fair to me. So, again... You know, Commissioner, and I say this with all due respect and very respectfully, but it's just interesting to me how I found that when you open these cans of worms in the legislature, you never know where they may lead and how people are going to react. I do think that I agree with you that I think that this should be something that you should be able to release. So I agree with you that far. And would like to support that. But I also really wonder whether we ought to reconsider whether these should be public, period. And we can't take any action here today anyway because we don't have a quorum. but I think you raise a very interesting issue for us.
Madam Chair, to the best of my knowledge, the state legislature, in their wisdom a couple of years ago, made sweeping changes to condemnation rules and regulations.
Yes.
and raised the bar on public involvement and the expenses that we have to give to people for their own private appraisals versus our own private appraisals. And I mean, our dollar amounts jumped tremendously. We the public are paying for many of those private appraisals on the condemnation side. Now, I'm here addressing you about working with willing individuals that are stepping forward, and I'm your comments as it pertains to condemnation opens up a whole different array of questions and concerns, and as I said, the legislature addressed this a couple of years ago and made some sweeping changes. Mr. Carlson from the MICA organization might be able to address that a little bit better than I do.
Okay.
I can.
Well, Commissioner, thank you. I do recall that because that was, I think, right before I came into the legislature, but there was, I just like everyone else, was reading about this in the paper. It was a big issue, not just here, but nationally. So I don't know what the history is with regard to why we would go through the expense of two appraisals and put all of that, the need for that in place, as opposed to simply saving money for local governments and just making that initial appraisal public so that someone might feel that they didn't need to spend the money on a private appraisal. I don't know. Maybe there's a really good reason for it, but.
Called negotiations, Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Sir, I just had one observation. You had said that earlier in your testimony that if you were dealing with a property owner that was either contrary or difficult. Did I assume that's what the justification of the discretionary authority that you would have as a political subdivision, that then you may choose not to give that information to that individual?
Commissioner Harris?
Madam Chair, Senator, language that we're requesting is that governmental agencies may be would allow us to make our appraisals public if we would choose. So my answer to you, Senator, would be yes. It would be up to the local unit of government to make that decision. Under current law, we can't make it public. And we're asking for the discretion to make it public in certain situations.
And if we go down the discretionary route, Madam Chair, this proposal would not have any conditions or standards to determine the discretionary power of the political subdivision. The person requesting it wishes, let's say they're the property owner. Let's say they're working in, even if they're working in good faith, or they just are wanting to know what information on their property that, or even their neighbor's property, is worth according to a publicly paid for appraisal. There's no checkoff list to determine if there's conditions that are met. It's solely at the objective and subjective judgment of the political subdivision. That's what you're requesting here. So I'm a little uncomfortable about not having some default as far as some conditions, or if someone sought it, at least if they made good faith, they want to know some information, they're going to get it no matter what, unless other things come into play. And I'm a little concerned about giving a sole discretionary power on this type of information simply for that reason. I don't know of too many other places in our data practices law that we give discretion of giving the opportunity to give publicly paid documentation out to some people and say no to other people simply because of the discretion of a governing board. I'm not sure. Usually we standardize it, and or we make it totally open, or in the interest of protecting the individual, we keep it private. And so that's what maybe is missing here.
So please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Keith Carlson, Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association, and full disclosure, Dakota County is a member of the association. I think we need to clarify what the current practice is under the eminent domain law that really somewhat supersedes the current data practices law classification of this property. Under current law, when an eminent domain proceedings is contemplated for a parcel, the acquiring entity must do at least one appraisal of that property at least 60 days before they actually file a petition for the taking of the property. They must share that appraisal with the owner of the property that they're trying to acquire. So it's not quite as the committee has been discussing to the point. The information does become available to the owner before any taking occurs, before any petition is acquired. And if there are multiple appraisals that the acquiring entity has, upon request, they have to provide it to that property owner. Again, the basis of this, the current classification statute is when they're trying to negotiate a sale purchase before eminent domain proceedings have occurred. Once eminent domain is initiated, basically the confidential status of the data is eliminated by the operations of the current eminent domain statute.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. That's been very helpful. Actually makes me feel a lot better. But again, having that background is the kind of thing we need to understand to put this in context, I think. And so that was very helpful. So it sounds as though this is more a situation where, as you said, Commissioner, in a voluntary circumstance. I'm just wondering, and then I think we should move to another thing because we got a late start here, but how would you feel the same way in terms of wanting to be able to do this if we simply said that in a voluntary, under a voluntary sale type of circumstance, the county shall, upon the request, disclose this information? Would there be any problem with doing that?
We don't want to speak for all of us. That would change
that. Madam Chair, that's a rather broad statement that affects a lot of other governmental agencies, not knowing what their positions would be, but I'd have to accept your comments and get word back how we would feel about that.
Mr. Carlson?
Madam Chair, if I could just provide some additional comment. I think the statutory change that Dakota County is seeking is basically to allow the sharing of appraisals where you have a willing seller, and they basically want to provide the disclosure that will facilitate the ultimate sale of that property without possibly having to go through an eminent domain proceedings if the county, the city, whoever has to get that property for such project. Where you don't have a voluntary or a willing seller, then I think generally governmental entities, until such time as they initiate the eminent domain proceedings, in which case the appraisal does become in effect, private data that is available to the seller that we would want to maintain the current confidential or non-public status of the information.
Okay, thank you. Senator Moi?
Madam Chair, thank you. Mr. Carlson and Commissioner, can you just remind me a little bit, and I apologize, Madam Chair, for being late. The Tax Committee went on a little bit longer than I anticipated. The this section of the bill, did we have a chance to hear this in the Senate Judiciary Committee or in the Data Practice Subcommittee, Madam Chair?
Madam Chair, or Senator Moi, I do not. Well, I know we didn't hear it, and I'm not sure that it was even introduced on the Senate side.
Mr. Carlson or Commissioner, was this ever a bill? Is there a companion, and who is the author on the Senate side, if there was one?
Madam Chair, Senator,
Commissioner?
No, there was not a companion bill in the Senate. It's my understanding. It's amendment to the House.
Oh, Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer?
Madam Chair, as an interested party in this particular segment of the House bill, was there ever an attempt by anyone to inform any senator of the intent for legislation? Did anyone seek an author on the Senate side? Do you know?
Mr. Carlson or Commissioner?
No. The record said no.
Madam Chair, no.
Okay, thank you, sir. Senator Moi?
Well, Madam Chair, it seems to me that on something like this, I mean, we did pass, and I don't know if it's become law yet or not, but we did pass a assessor-appraiser bill where something like this would have been an appropriate amendment for a conversation, whether on the Senate floor or in committee, for that conversation with or without being in this perilous opportunity here. So,
Senator
it's just too bad.
As we have stated, kind of as a precursor to our meeting here, out of respect for the people who took their time sitting here with us for half an hour waiting to see, what might happen here today, we really bent over backwards to want to try to accommodate them and accommodate the House, even though the situation is as it is. So, gentlemen, we just really appreciate the fact that you've given us this information. Again, we can't act on it. We don't have a quorum. But at least we have a much better understanding now of the provision in the House bill and the reason why you're requesting it. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for listening to our presentation.
Thank you. The next, I think, item that we have in the House file that we don't have any companion language for in the Senate file would be House Article 1, Section 7, having to do with private donor gift data.
Hey, Madam Chair and members, my name is Judd Shetland. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Metropolitan Council, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here before you to talk about the language that is included in the House bill. What this legislation would do would amend Minnesota Statute 13.792 to allow for the exemption to the data practices law concerning donations to the Regional Park Foundation. It's a new park foundation established by the Metropolitan Council that Senator Pappas and Senator Rest carried the bill for us in 2007. We were able to put the Park Foundation together, and last year we moved forward with a bill that had a variety of Metropolitan Council issues, including this provision in the bill. The bill ended up being set aside, so the Senate companion did not get picked up. However, we were able to put it in the House Data Practices Bill last year, and it is carried over, obviously, from that bill. So you will not see a Senate companion. However, there were no issues with the particular provision last year. Now, the goal of the Park Foundation is to raise some private donations to supplement the and raise awareness of our regional park system, and we're assuming and hoping that this provision will allow us to hopefully generate some additional gifts from private donors who may be may not want to have that information made available. And the Minnesota Zoo Foundation and the University of Minnesota Foundation have that status, and we're just asking to be included in that particular status. I believe it is a pretty simple request, and I would be happy to take any questions. And I know Mr. Hamilton is here with a similar request for the folks from the State Council and the Blind.
Thank you, gentlemen, for being here. I know as this was explained to me, there were some difficulties getting donors to be willing to contribute because it would require them to make certain financial information available that would not be something that they would otherwise disclose. It would be kind of a violation of the privacy of their financial information is the way that this was explained to me. But I don't know, I know that this is different than a request that the University of Minnesota had last year, but a little bit along the same lines. And so I think we need to make sure that we have an opportunity in the Senate to find out if there is any opposition or concern to this provision, or if this is simply more, you know, kind of something that's commonly done. So by bringing it up here, we can do that. Sarah Moore.
Madam Chair, can I just get a clarification? Was this a bill last session that got into another bill, but that we just didn't flag it and we missed the opportunity to bring it to the Data Practice Subcommittee? I'm just trying to decide how this ended up in the House bill, but that then the Senate. That we're not aware of it right. In the Judiciary Committee.
Floor amendment.
Mr. Shetman?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator. We had a broader Metropolitan Council bill that dealt with Chapter 473, that this was a provision, and when the bill was sent to the State and Local Government Committee that Senator Rest has, we pulled that bill. However, it was moving forward in the House, and we decided not to move forward with it because there was an issue. However, we were able to take that provision, and it was Representative Wagenius who had that bill that dealt with a watershed piece, and the watershed piece went away, but it was picked up and put into Representative Mullery's data practices bill at that point. And so, no, the Senate did not get an opportunity to hear it because the bill was basically pulled in Senator Rest committee, and it didn't meet deadline at that point. However, one of the things that we were asked to do is to talk to Mr. Neumeister, who was had a lot of, opinions about the Metropolitan Council and our data practices requests, and I don't know if it makes any difference to the committee here, but he had issues with other part of the bill, but understood that this was just basically protecting private donor data, and it didn't cause any red flags with him, and that was a big deal with the House.
Well, Sarah Moi, and then I have a comment in response to that, too. They may be similar.
Yes.
Well, last time I checked, Madam Chair, there was no Senator Neumeister.
No.
There was no Senator Neumeister on the Judiciary Committee. We heard a lot of bills this year in Judiciary, Madam Chair. I mean, a lot of bills. We put in a lot of hours. I think both you and Senator Limmer can attest to that. And if these provisions were this significant, and if the Senate hadn't had a chance to see it, I don't know what the difficult would have been to just jacket this and just shoot it to us. And we would have given it the hearing and the opportunity for it to be reviewed. And obviously, we would not be in the pickle that we're in here. To our friends who would like us to help you all, is that we are the certain body that will get things passed around here. I mean, you can put your money on us, and you'll get the return on that investment.
Well, I don't know about me.
Except for Senator Limmer. Yeah. But I mean, I just think that if you had to put your money down, I mean, look who showed up today. So going forward, I don't know if we'll all be back, but going forward, if the same cast of characters are back here, let that be a lesson to all of us. That I am disappointed because these are really good provisions that I want to. I mean, I'm sitting here scheming on how I can get these provisions as amendments to other bills in the Senate floor that are still open.
Right.
So I just, you know, I think that I just want that on the record, and I think you're aware of that. But it's unfortunate that these weren't jacketed and just have it introduced, because the Senate would have taken care of business for you.
And Madam Chair, and
Mr.
members,
Chetnan.
In regards to Mr. Neumeister, that was in regard to your question about if there was any opposition to the bill. Obviously,
okay.
I'm well aware of how who makes the decisions around here. I was just hoping that to be an expression of whether or not there was opposition or not.
Well, and Mr. Chetnan, just for the benefit of everyone here, because I know that we're all very familiar with Mr. Neumeister, I guess we just want to. Maybe there's a little bit of sensitivity because while Mr. Neumeister is a regular attendee of committee hearings and certainly over the years has expressed opinions that people respect his dedication to this issue, at the same time, we want to make sure that there isn't any confusion in terms of boundaries. Mr. Neumeister is a citizen who has a right to have opinions, but vetting things through Mr. Neumeister or Mr. I think, you know, just make sure that it's clear that that's not a substitute for vetting things through the legislators, or that making it clear that the legislators ultimately are going to make the decisions.
And Madam,
Mr. Chetnan.
Yep, excuse me, Madam Chair and members, and I 100% understand that and appreciate that. I know you'd mentioned that the House, and understand the House isn't here. And just for clarification issues, that was one of the things that they wanted me to do as part of this particular bill, was to work with him and make sure that he was okay with this. So for the benefit of the Senate, doesn't sound like it's much of a benefit at all, but I was just trying to clarify how that worked out, at least on the House side, and if the House members okay. were here. That was one of the things that they had asked that I do as far as this bill. So okay. I understand very clearly, that's what I meant. By
sure. That. Thank you. And as you, I'm sure you know, and as Senator Moore expressed, we really want to try to help you get this done, or we wouldn't be sitting here without the House members taking testimony on something they've got in a bill where they didn't even come. So
that's right. I appreciate that.
Okay. Sure. Thank you. Senator Limmer.
Sure. Just, I know we are having a good discussion on process, but I wanted to bring our discussion back to policy. And if we have an opportunity to meet between now and the end of session regarding this, one of the questions I would have is, it seems like we're expanding the keeping private donor gift lists from the public. That's really what this is about. And there was concern raised, and I can attest to my own questioning last year about certain requests by the University of Minnesota. The university is a different animal altogether, with considerable state investment. And I do question whether or not we should keep private lists of donors that could have very significant influence on the decisions made by the University of Minnesota, and in light of the considerable state investment. I do consider that to be going in the wrong direction. But nevertheless, these particular entities that are now seeking the same treatment as the University of Minnesota, it does seem like we're expanding, and I'm sure in the next few years we'll have even more people wanting to cover and protect their donors and the people that give money to these quasi-governmental agencies. So I know we can't keep talking on this because we got a lot of coverage to go, but the question that I have is, in the event that we do have further discussion, I may be asking another question later on so that the witnesses are prepared, that who are we really trying to protect and why? And that's the only question that I would have. I don't need to have an answer right now.
Mr. Chetton and Mr. Hamilton, what I would advise you to do is maybe take a few minutes to visit with Senator Limmer, because I do think this is distinguishable from that situation. But I think if you can have a conversation with them, that would be helpful.
All right.
So thank you, gentlemen. Mr. Hamilton?
Madam Chair, my name is Chuck Hamilton. I represent State Services for the Blind, a part of state government, a Department of Employment and Economic Development. This situation came to our attention on or after March 15th of this year. As soon as it came to our attention, because we've had private donors since 1953, we immediately came to the Capitol. We did meet with the members of the committee that are here. The advice was to attempt to get an amendment on the floor of the House to add our name to this list, which we were able to do. Prior to 2.5 years ago, the information that's laid out in 13.792, items 1 through 7, were actually held by a private foundation, the St. Paul Foundation. Because of matters that they were taking care of, it required us then to become the employer of a fundraiser. At that time, then, we had possession of data that's listed there. It did not come to our radar screen, unfortunately, until on or after March 15th of this year that there was some exposure here, and it came as a result of a couple calls from donors. It will have impact if we do not gain that kind of protection. The money that we raise goes directly for our communication center, which the Ham family started in 1953 with a sizable donation. We raise roughly $200,000 to $500,000 per year, which is a significant portion of that state entity, funded by private individuals and corporations to a minor extent, et cetera. So it's imperative that we do what we can to maintain that level of private support, which therefore does not require the request for state funds to handle these state activities. So that's what, when we discovered a problem, we did see this bill that was in the House and then took immediate action with the House and Senate and followed that advice. We'd appreciate the support of the Senate if this bill goes forward.
Thank you, Mr. Hamilton, for that explanation. And I guess also just quickly comment to Senator Limmer that to me, when we're talking about private donor gift data, that's a different kind of thing than when we're talking about financial investments, which was what we were talking about last year. These are people voluntarily giving money who just don't want to open up their financial records or perhaps even their name. But I would think there would be a different kind of public interest in knowing about how money is invested. So I think that's, in my mind at least, really the where there's a distinction. Mr. Hamilton?
Madam Chair, one final point, I think, related to that. Going to the bill, R4, line 7.22, for the record, it's already statutorily required that the names of donors and the range of gifts, so there is a public side to this. We think that's a good balance. But the rest of those items, 1 through 7, get rather personal. If someone is only going to give you $10, it's no big deal. But when you're going after to be represented in their will, and that exposes all sorts of other information, that's another matter. So I appreciate your time for considering this.
Thank you, Mr. Hamilton. I think that was very helpful. Thank you both, gentlemen.
Yep, thank you.
Now, let's see. I think the next House provision. Well, first of all, I guess I should ask if there was anyone else that wanted to testify on that provision. Is there any other person here who's interested? Okay. I think those were the two main areas that we have not heard, had not heard any testimony about. Ms. Pontius, do you know if there was anything else? Is there anyone else here who would like to testify about a subject that hasn't been in front of the Senate, as long as you have that opportunity here? Is there anyone else who wants to testify in general about the bill? Okay. Not seeing anyone else here to testify then, do the members have any other questions or comments at this point? Any discussion?
Madam Chair, I just want to apologize to members of the public and to thank them for making the time to be here, at least from the Senate's perspective. I think that it is unfortunate that the other body is not here, and we will try to find a way to rectify that. And if we can still, I, for one, as a member of this conference committee, would like to be able to put a conference committee report together. And so I appreciate the public being here to give us information, and we will take that into consideration as we try to move forward.
Okay. Commissioner, would you state your name for the record, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Steve Hoffmeyer. I'm Commissioner of the Minnesota Bureau of Mediation Services. I'd like to just make a couple of comments, if I could, on the proposed legislation that is on page R10. The Senate language is 10.14 and 10.15. The House language is 5.5 and 5.6. First of all, let me say that as Commissioner of Minnesota Bureau of Mediation Services, I would prefer more comments and more testimony to the committee from labor relations advocates, management, and union representatives. I can comment about this language potential effect on the Bureau of Mediation Services. For a long time, we've had a statutory mandate in Minnesota Statutes 179A to make arbitration decisions, to be the official repository of arbitration decisions, and to make those decisions available to the public. This may have an impact that I'm not certain if it will impact our statute or not. I'd like to ask the committee to consider that possible impact. And I could see a potential negative impact for employers, for unions, and for individual employees with this proposed language. Basically, that point would be that frequently the accusations of misdeeds by public employees are very public in nature. And this language contemplates a complete exoneration of those charges. If I was in that situation as a public employee who had been accused of misdeeds, I would like the public employer to be able to acknowledge that an impartial arbitrator decision was the official result in this matter, rather than only prohibiting the public employer from commenting on the official result, rather than leaving it up to the union or the public employees themselves. Additionally, the unions must have the ability to explain the decision to their membership. And another point, the public employees can come to us for under independent review provision under Minnesota Statutes 179A to receive an arbitrator assignment, as can employees in state government under Minnesota Statute Chapter 43A to receive an independent review and arbitrator process for their decision, for their accusations. Additionally, a number of employee forums that are available to challenge employer actions exist, which would not be subject to this limitation. Those include worker compensation, veterans preference, human rights challenges, district court, which could contemplate a multiplicity of court actions. Also, teacher discharge hearings are also not subject to this limitation. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. And Senators Limmer and Senator Moi, Commissioner briefly visited with me about this issue this morning, and I have to admit that since it's been over a year since we heard the testimony about it, I had not a perfect memory of who brought this to us and what the reason for this was. Since we have identical provisions here, it would be probably only fair, again, to hear again from the reason, and maybe Ms. Beyer-Kopinski can remind us. But it seems to me that We've spent a lot of work in the Judiciary Committee talking about expungement and the opportunity for second chances and not having, for example, when someone's arrested and nothing more happens, having that be something that prevents them then from getting a job or getting housing. And so this seemed to fall into one of those categories of something where if someone had been disciplined and it was deemed to have been totally without merit and no further disciplinary action taken, that we would not want to have that as something that becomes a black mark on someone's employment record, where if they're releasing their records in a subsequent, you know, for subsequent employment, that they would have this old disciplinary information still on their file. And even if they're exonerated, it still could raise someone's eyebrows. And I think that was the reason for doing this. Certainly someone, if they voluntarily wanted to give the certificate or the document that showed from the mediation that showed that they were exonerated, they would still be free to do that. So I think that was our thinking at the time. And I don't recall that anyone came forward and expressed concerns from the other direction, whether from the media or from labor or anyone else. But now you have raised this concern, and you know, we certainly appreciate that point of view. Maybe Ms. Beyer-Kopinski, or maybe it would require some further discussion to say, is this really going to be a problem for people? I don't know. I mean, I can certainly see that there are considerations either way. Ms. Beyer-Kopinski?
Madam Chair and members, this was a provision that admin brought forward. It was okay to clarify what we believed was already the legislature's intent, that when an employee covered by collective bargaining completely won in arbitration, since there, when you win in arbitration, there's no discipline if you completely win, so that if you don't get discipline, there's no final decision about discipline, so that nothing would be public other than what you've already said, which is there was a complaint and it's closed, that there was a Court of Appeals case from 2004 where it said even though the employee got completely reinstated with back pay and all discipline was removed, that it was still going to be public. And with that Court of Appeals decision out there that others, you know, that BMS and others could rely on, we wanted to come back and be able to clarify what was your intent as to this, because we didn't believe that this Court of Appeals case represented that intent of yours. So we brought it forward, and we didn't hear, most folks said, yes, that is what we believe your intent to be, but certainly should you choose a different policy, you're the policymakers, but we wanted to codify what we thought your intent was.
Sarah Moore?
Madam Chair, so Ms. Beyer-Kopinski, given the differences in the Senate and the House language, which language would take care of admin's desires?
Madam Chair,
Ms. Beyer-Kopinski?
The language in each side is identical.
Yeah, it's same language. Sarah Moore, we just didn't, the reason it's coming up now is because the commissioner came forward with a concern about the language that we hadn't heard about last year, but we have the same provision in both the House and Senate bills. Commissioner, in light of Ms. Beyer-Kopinski's comments, do you have a reaction, or does that clarify anything in terms of the intent, or would you still have the same concern?
Well, I believe that the our statute 179A that makes the requirement upon the Bureau to make the decisions public to any person who wants them can be read in harmony with the proposed change, in that this provision is in the personnel data of the public employer of that public employee, not affecting and not addressing the 179A mandate for our office to make those decisions public to anybody who asks for them.
And so, Commissioner, would it be the case that, so for example, the kinds of decisions you would make maybe over a claim that someone's bringing is under a different section? Is that what you're saying? So that you're still going to make those kinds of things public, but this is really dealing with a different subject matter?
All the arbitration decisions come to our agency, whether they're of grievance and discipline, as this language is addressing, whether public employer or private employer is subject to our jurisdiction also. And we have made those public since 1939, when the agency was first established. It's always been available for somebody to come over to the office, look through file cabinets, look through file folders. only recently we've started to put those onto a website to make them available to the public from whatever web location they wish to access us.
State your name for the record, please.
My name is Barbara Holmes. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Labor Relations at Minnesota Management and Budget. The way this new language, at least how I see it, would apply to the employer, and I represent the employer in arbitration matters, is that, again, if an arbitrator completely sustained the grievance, said there was no discipline, that would mean when we were contacted as the employer for this sort of information, again, as Ms. Beyer-Kopinski said, all we can say is there was a complaint and the matter's closed. And so I don't, as the employer, have an issue with this language. What needs clarification for us is the Bureau of Mediation Services, although it's a state agency, it doesn't represent the employer. It doesn't represent the union. It's neutral in all the services that it provides. And it has this separate statutory duty to publish all arbitration awards. So the question is this intended for the employer as the employer or the Bureau of Mediation Services as a repository of all of these awards? The only other thing I can analogize it to is if you have a court hearing, obviously if an employee goes and sues in court, regardless of the outcome, that's public information. If you have other administrative sort of quasi-judicial hearings brought by an employee, very frequent, those decisions, whether they win or lose, are public. When it goes to the arbitration level, we're leaving state government, we're hiring an outside neutral arbitrator who has no connection with the government. We each pay for he or she is an independent contractor, and it's kind of like it takes it out of the realm. And should those decisions, is the public entitled to see those decisions? The argument on the side of, I think Senator Limmer talked about, you know, the balance between protecting, in this case, employee data and the right of the public to know what's going on. If you have a state agency who's out there taking discipline inappropriately and an arbitrator comes in and said, you stepped over the line, there's some the public has a right to know that. And it acts as sort of a balance, too. So those are some of the considerations that I see need to be made.
Let's see. I think we have first Ms. Pontius, I think, was going to shed a little light on something. Then Ms. Beyer-Kopinski and Commissioner will listen to all of your comments.
Oh, yeah, Madam Chair, members, I understand the problem here because it's, you know, it's not entirely clear. I sort of see it as the data having different part, like you've got the personnel data that's in the hands of the employer, but I don't see that law as necessarily carrying over to the Bureau of Mediation Services statute, which is separate. I don't know if it would help on, like, I'm looking on the Senate language on 5.5, if you were to say that it does not become public personnel data, if that would be enough to make it clear that this is only for purposes of the personnel data statute, but it obviously doesn't affect the other laws that this kind of data might, you know, because it's in different places and it might have different, you know, categorizations or whatever, depending on where it's at.
And if that's what you want to do, we just need the clarification that you want to accept those awards that are published by the BMS.
Ms. Beyer-Kopinski, do you have any thoughts on that?
Madam Chair and members, one other alternative too, they would still be able to publish their awards, but they, if this language passed and applied to them, they would have to redact personally identifiable information like the person's name. So you could still have award be public, but you wouldn't get to know it was me who was the subject of it. Or we could have this apply to arbitration awards that occur after the effective date of this so that they wouldn't have to go back and redact all the awards. And going forward, they could do them in a de-identified way. Our office also has, we issue advisory opinions, and we also have this obligation to make them publicly available. We use pseudonyms and redact them as needed, before we post them on the web. So they would be similar to any other, you know, government entity who has to sometimes redact not public data. So your policy decision really is, do you want it to be private personnel data, both at the government employers and at the Bureau of Mediation Services, or do you want it to be, you know, private at the government employer and public on the other end?
Well, Ms. Beyer-Kopinski, I like your first suggestion because it seems to me that if we are going to try to protect someone from someone else's wrong decision from a disciplinary standpoint, then we should try to protect them. And I do understand Ms. Holmes' comment, but it seems to me that that would provide a good balance, because if someone then is taking inappropriate disciplinary actions, you'd still have access to that information. Commissioner, would that be a workable solution for your department?
Which option was that, Madam Chair?
The one where we redact the personally identifying information of the person who was disciplined.
Well, when in doubt, we'll follow the law as you enact it. We've always taken the view from requests from parties in the past that the arbitrator's decision is a public record, is a final decision in the disciplinary matter, and that that's the document that gets appealed into the judiciary, into the court system. So we've been uncomfortable with any attempts in the past to try and redact information. And I'd be concerned about, you know, in labor relations, we try never to get an agreement that's going to cause more problems. And I guess that would raise an issue of, did we redact appropriately, or should we, how far down that road of redaction should we go?
Well, thank you. And now we have an issue we didn't even know we had coming here today. But Ms. Beyer-Kopinski, my suggestion would be, just in the interest of where we are right now, that perhaps we could have an amendment drafted either way. And then if we do get together with the House, we could have an opportunity to visit about this and decide from a policy discussion what we want to do. But otherwise, if we're not, that doesn't happen, then it may very well be that this will be a topic for further discussion next year. Thank you. Commissioner?
Can I make one other comment? We have just finished about a 6-year process of literally taking the office from the 1950s into the 21st century. We've finished a database and document management scanning system where we've literally scanned in thousands and thousands of documents from the 1940s on. So whatever might happen, it would be greatly appreciated if it was prospective only from like August 1st forward, mm-hmm. Because of the great volume of data we have in a database right now.
Thank you, Commissioner. Yeah. Thank you very much. We appreciate you bringing this to our attention.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who would like to testify who's been here today waiting? With that, the conference committee is in recess.